This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Drug overdose stories are still in the headlines, with legal challenges over the opioid epidemic now sweeping the nation. Here in Hawaii, meth cases still overshadow opioid deaths, but that doesn't mean it isn't a problem that our community is struggling with. We talked to Heather Lusk with the Hawaii Health and Harm Reduction Center about the Hawaii Opioid Initiative and a new online quiz.
This campaign is really focused on people that may have a prescription for pain medications or struggling with pain, and other folks that may be struggling with opioid use. And it gives them an opportunity to go online, take a very simple quiz to see if they may be at risk for dependence, get links to treatment options, as well as learn about things like overdose and safe disposal of medications. So we're really excited to provide this tool to the community to learn about their risk, but also to really try to drive folks to the HawaiiOpioid.org website to learn more.
What's the snapshot for opioid use here?
So we had about 600,000 prescriptions last year in Hawaii for pain medication. When you look at the continent, they've struggled much more with overdose than we have. It's still the leading cause of death in Hawaii. Overdose is, it's more than auto accidents. Though we're 50 out of 51 when you look at rates of overdose in the United States. So many folks feel that ice and methamphetamine is still the drug that's affecting us the most, and the data at the treatment centers support that. However, we are starting to see more fentanyl in the islands. That's what's really caused a lot of the overdose deaths and havoc, particularly in Middle and East Coast, and both the West Coast and Hawaii seeing more. So we're trying to get ahead of that with the Hawaii Opioid Initiative and this awareness campaign.
Okay, because we just need to start talking about it.
Exactly. And that's what this quiz is designed to do. So I don't think I've ever met somebody who hasn't known someone touched by opioid use disorder, overdose. And so this very easy quiz is anonymous. It allows folks to answer a few easy questions, and then a detailed referral or resources they can print out and take to their doctor and be able to learn more about treatment options in Hawaii. Opioid use disorder is one of the only substances, in addition to alcohol, that actually has medications approved for treatment. So we can link people to those. We can tell folks how to, again, appropriately dispose of their opioid medications so they don't go into our water supply or go out into the community. But most of all, we want folks to know, are you at risk for opioid misuse? And if so, there's lots of things you can do for you and your loved ones to get help.
I just read an article. The story was from the mainland, and they talked about how, because there's a lot of attention on opioids, that a lot of people are now going to meth.
Yeah, I saw that article too, Catherine. And it's, I think we already know that in Hawaii. We've had so many generations of methamphetamine use. But to be honest, our data and some other data is also indicating, even in Hawaii, those that have dependence on opioids, especially when some interventions really stopped people's access without maybe addressing the underlying substance use disorder, then they go to any substance they can get their hands on, honestly. So we're seeing a lot more what we call poly-substance use, or multiple drugs, and that's what we're hearing from our sites, our treatment facilities, and the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division at DOH. So we are trying to leverage all these resources, this extra money on opioids, and the attention to actually change the entire substance use system and the entire substance use response system. And I think we've really done that with the Hawaii Opioid Initiative, and we're really excited that on October 1, the Department of Health is launching Hawaii Cares, which will be a coordinated 24-hour substance use referral network that folks can get access to treatment and resources 24/7 in Hawaii.
And we should mention that we're coming up on a really significant milestone for the needle exchange program.
So Hawaii was the first state to have statewide syringe access, and it's kept the HIV rate in Hawaii very low, according to the Department of Health. So it's been 30 years. So in conjunction with the Hawaii Department of Health and International Overdose Awareness Day, on Thursday, August 29th at 11:30, we're inviting the community to come to Harris Methodist Church and both honor anybody you've lost to overdose and talk about and learn about overdose and get access to naloxone. And then we'll have a panel with some policymakers and Department of Health to talk about the last 30 years in Hawaii of syringe access and syringe exchange in the Aloha State.
Yeah, because it's important, I think, to acknowledge the different programs that we've tried here in the community. You know, what's worked, what hasn't, you know, what do we do going forward? How do we make it better?
Yeah, and I really appreciate you saying that, because part of the uniqueness of Hawaii and having, we were the first state to have this, but it's also codified in Hawaii revised statute, and that mandates some research. So we do research every year to learn what's working, what doesn't, and folks can learn more about this activity or any of our evaluation or data efforts at www.hhhrc.org. And the event is free, and as I mentioned, in addition to lessons learned about the Syringe Exchange for the past 30 years, we will also be doing a memorial, training, and in-service and distributing naloxone. Just to note, naloxone reverses opioids, and we've had over 230 people that have been reported to us saved from naloxone distributed through our program.
In all your years working on this program, is there any particular case or story that maybe touched you?
Yeah, actually. So I'll call him Joe. And he, like many folks, has been doing physical labor in Hawaii. He was a construction working, was union. And then he had an injury on the job, was on workman's comp, and had a significant injury that led him to some pain medication, that led him to some dependence. And then when his workman's comp ran out and he felt forced to come back to work, was in a lot of pain. And he shared that in order to keep food on the table and feed his family, he felt the need to keep taking pain medication to manage his pain to make money. Before you know it, his physician was cut off the pain meds. He had a hard time finding anybody else. And then next thing you know, because of his dependence and needing to kind of keep up withdrawal and keep well, he found himself to the streets finding heroin and got into our program. So the good news of this is that he has gotten into a program where there is medications for opioid use disorder. It's called Suboxone. He has now been free of heroin for a long time, is reunited with his family and working again. But this could have had a very different ending, yeah, Catherine, because he was doing what he was supposed to do and then got that dependence. And then didn't get the support he needed to address it, and then was kind of forced to deal with it. And we've seen too many stories like that, Catherine, where well-meaning providers cut people off of their pain medications, and that causes them to go into a panic, and sometimes then that brings them to the street to find whatever relief they can find. So I'm glad Joe's story had a positive outcome, but there's too many others that we find die of overdose of shame if they relapse, or find a very slippery slope when they find other ways to get their pain managed. But we're excited about some new initiatives happening. I mentioned the CARES. That's going to be this coordinated one-stop shop to get linkage to substance use treatment. And we have some stabilization and detox resources coming online. That's a big gap in our system, Catherine. If you're addicted or dependent on opioids, it's really hard to find a place that can manage you to detox from them. And you can't go into treatment until you detox. So there's this weird cycle. And so we're really excited about those efforts, doing more on the medications for treatment. And the other biggest success, Catherine, is our work with public safety. I just want to really give a shout out to the Hawaii Opioid Initiative. And I've done public health for 25 years now to age myself. And I have never been involved in such an exciting public health, public safety partnership as the Hawaii Opioid Initiative. We have partnerships with HIDA, and our narcotics folks and our county police officers and the sheriffs and everyone working together, because we can't arrest our way out of this crisis. And they really get that there needs to be a public health and balanced public safety response. And that gives me hope, because the more that we can get people the help they need and the support they need and not incarcerate them for what we know is a health issue, I think we're moving in the right direction.
Okay. Is there anything else going on the neighbor islands?
Yeah, what's interesting is that there is a couple interesting things. So they've done some mapping of where the overdoses are happening, and so the Department of Health has, and law enforcement. So we're going to be able to do some more targeting efforts and also maybe know what portions of the state are more affected, particularly by opioid use disorder and methamphetamine too. So we're also looking at methamphetamine overdoses. And Catherine, even though we've addressed opioid overdoses and reduced those because of naloxone, we've seen an increase in methamphetamine-related deaths in Hawaii.
Where are the numbers higher on the neighbor islands? Which neighbor island?
Probably not surprising to you, Puna area and Hawaii Ocean View Estates on the Big Island. On this island, there's actually still obviously town, but also more on the west side than we would expect.
That was Heather Lusk, Executive Director of the Hawaii Health and Harm Reduction Center. This week, the Health Department launched an online quiz that could help determine your vulnerability and risk factors. And Thursday, August 29th, marks International Drug Overdose Awareness Day. There's an event at Harris Methodist Church marking the 30th anniversary of Hawaii's syringe exchange.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaiian Airlines, celebrating its 90th anniversary with international service to Japan, Korea, Australia, New Zealand, and the South Pacific. Reservations at hawaiianairlines.com.
The University of Hawaii is back in session, and that means more commuters on the road. At UH Manoa, many of those cars may have trouble finding a place to park once they arrive on campus. HPR's Ryan Finnerty joins us to discuss that challenge. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. So, yeah, everyone this week has probably heard the warnings to expect worse traffic on the roads on Oahu because UH is back in session. And at the flagship campus in Manoa, that means there's about an additional 15,000 people on the road that weren't there the week before. And that doesn't even take into account UH West Oahu and the various community colleges around the island. So it is quite a significant increase. And for those of us who aren't going to campus, we just have to deal with the extra traffic. But for the students and staff who are going, they have another problem when they get there, and that's trying to find parking. And there just simply aren't enough parking spots for every student and employee to get one, to get a space on campus. I spoke with Noelani Aga, who's from the UH Manoa Commuter Services Office, to get a better sense of the challenge they're facing.
There's about 5,000 or so stalls campus-wide. Enrollment for this year, it's about 17,000. So if we're giving parking permits to faculty, staff, and students, of course the 5,000 is definitely not going to be enough. So unfortunately, that means some of the undergrad students aren't able to get parking permits, but we do have alternative means for them to get on campus.
And we'll talk about some of those alternative means a little bit later, but as Noelani said, 17,000 undergraduate students enrolled at UH Manoa this semester. That's on top of several thousand employees, so faculty and administrators and support staff. And they are all, under their union contract, required to have the option to purchase parking. So before any students get a crack at it, those employees have to go first. So just keep that number in mind, 5,000 stalls, as we kind of go through some of the numbers. This year, according to the university, there are about 3,500 students living on campus. So that means there's still, you know, more than 10,000, 12,000, 13,000 students that are not living on the campus that need to get there every day. And we don't know where exactly they're all coming from, but anecdotally, talking to people, a lot of them are living pretty far away in West Oahu or Central Oahu, which means that biking or public transit isn't necessarily as feasible for them. One of those students who I spoke with is a third-year undergraduate. Her name is Kanoena Singh. She lives in Mililani, which is where she went to high school and grew up. And she drives to campus every day. And we heard earlier that not every undergrad can get a semester-long parking pass. Kanoena is one of those who has not been able to get one. She's never gotten one yet. And so I talked to her a little bit about how she's been dealing with that and how that affects her life.
Oh, this past school year has been kind of a headache. I would leave home anywhere between 4 and 5:30, depending on what time my first class started. They only sold about 150 of the daily passes, so I had to be one of the first 150 students to buy those since I didn't have a parking permit. So we kind of established a schedule to do carpooling now because they have carpooling passes, but it kind of takes a toll on all of us since we have to wake up for each other's different schedules and leaving at different times.
So what she was describing there is there are these semester-long parking passes that students and faculty can get, and then of that, those take up a certain portion of those 5,000 stalls that we heard about earlier, and then another smaller percentage of them are reserved for daily parking passes. So people probably use that like when they go to a sporting event or go up just during the day for a meeting or something. There are spots that are held in these daily lots. And so these students who commute by car but don't qualify for a semester-long pass have to compete for these daily passes. And so that's why they're getting there so early. A lot of them end up having to go and park in neighborhoods, Manoa or Palolo or wherever, if those daily lots fill up. So it really does become this highly competitive thing. And the reason that a student like Kanawana isn't qualifying for a pass is because they're done based off seniority. So the employees go first, and then graduate students, and then undergrads. And then, you know,
it's a pecking order.
Exactly. And then within the undergraduate population, seniors and then juniors and so on. And so Kanawana said that for most undergrads, they're not even getting the option to buy a pass until maybe their second semester junior year, but oftentimes not until their senior year. So they have to come up with these other options. And you might be thinking at this point, well, why not just build more parking? It seems like a pretty obvious solution. The university administration has said they don't want to do that. They want to encourage people to use alternative means of transportation. And they do offer some alternatives. There's a discounted bus pass, a city bus pass, for the neighborhoods immediately surrounding the campus. There is a free shuttle called the Rainbow Shuttle. And if you drive in that area, you might have seen it. It makes stops in Palolo, Manoa, Makiki, and that's free for students and faculty. But a lot of commuters do seem to prefer their cars still. Hawaii's a car culture, and that creates this problem of parking scarcity. And we have this situation where demand for parking exceeds supply, but the supply is not going to increase, and that's what the university has said, which to me sounded like a pretty basic economics problem. So I wanted to talk to an economist about it, and I spoke with Professor John Lynam, who's an economics professor at UH. And this is how he said he kind of assessed the situation.
From a purely economist perspective, parking, especially on upper campus, is too cheap. And so more people want to buy it at the current price than there are spots available. In all these cases, the most efficient way to allocate parking would be to raise the price. If people think that's unfair, there may be other ways kind of addresses some of the inequality concerns, but could still get you at a more efficient outcome. One way might be, instead of charging people a set price, it could be a percentage of your salary, so that wealthier faculty are not favored over a more junior faculty. I mean, one way that would be very efficient is just to have a lottery amongst everybody that wants it, but then allow people to transfer those to other faculty members if they so, or students if they so wish to do so.
So, Catherine, that's a pretty basic principle of economics, is that if demand exceeds supply, the price is too low and you need to raise it. Probably a lot of people out there were shrieking at their radio when they heard that as a solution. But the basic logic is that if it was more expensive, it wouldn't be as attractive, fewer people would do it, and then alternatives like the bus or something else would be more attractive. There are special passes for carpooling that are cheaper and in a separate pool. So there are efforts made to encourage carpooling. There's cheaper passes for mopeds and motorcycles. So there are some alternatives out there that are still kind of drive-centric. And the UH Board of Regents did approve a pretty substantial increase to parking last year. It's phased in over 6 years. But by 2025, when those rates come to maturity, some of the passes will have more than doubled from what they were in 2018. So that wasn't done to address the parking shortage. That was done to fund maintenance issues associated with parking and that kind of thing. But it may have an unintended effect of reducing the shortage. John Lynam also said that UH could try using financial or social incentives to encourage people to drive less. So it could be something like awards for people who, you know, don't use their car, or some kind of financial aid for not driving.
And I know historically, too, we've seen some families in Manoa selling parking passes. You know, you pay for parking and they'll let you park on their lawn for
$100
a month.
And that's, you know, another market solution to the problem. The university doesn't have a rule about parking in the neighborhood or not. They just have guidelines for students to do it respectfully, abide by all normal parking rules. And they said they haven't had a significant number of complaints from neighborhood boards or anything like that. And with the students I spoke to, that was a very common option, to park in a neighborhood rather than pay for the pass. And if these prices continue to increase, we may see more of that, and, you know, unclear what kind of issues that will or will not generate in the future.
Yeah, and I'd be curious to see what all the parking over at St. Francis School since the school's not operating.
Yeah, the university, as I mentioned earlier, said they don't have any plans to increase parking that they operate and maintain. Certainly you could see a third party come in and try and offer something to students, but the administration was pretty unequivocal that they want people to drive less. They want fewer people parking on campus rather than making more parking.
Right. Okay. Thanks so much, Ryan.
Sure thing.
We've been talking with HPR's Ryan Finnerty about the parking issues at UH Manoa.
I'm Bert Lum. Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we'll catch up on the civic tech scene and talk about the 4th Hawaii Annual Code Challenge. We'll find out how the hack has evolved to engage both government departments along with citizens to tackle pressing problems. That's today at 6:30 p.m. on Bite Marks Cafe.
Hi, Ray Cruz here, host of Latin Beat. Join me Saturday, September 7th, for a members-only event in HPR's Atherton Studio. It's a Latin jazz concert with Freddie Miranda Jr. and his knockout band, plus a pre-show reception with the artist. For tickets, visit hprtickets.org or call the station during business hours. Sponsored by Amoresco.
Sand replenishing. It's a solution to our eroding beaches on the South Shore that is the subject of today's reality check. Honolulu Civil Beats reporter Christina Jedra on the line this morning. Hi there.
Hi, good to be here.
Yes, so we're talking the sand replenishment project at Ala Moana Beach Park, right?
Right, yeah. So the city is planning this major makeover of the whole park, which includes this controversial playground, but also this sand replenishment project. And basically what that means is they're going to dredge a bunch of sand from offshore and bring it to the shoreline to widen the beach, which is great news for beachgoers, but not so great news for the critters that live in the sand.
Yeah, and this is an expensive endeavor here.
It is. It's a $10 million project. The funding's already been approved by City Council, and they're hoping to get to work sometime next year.
So what's the situation with the environmental impact study?
Yeah, so the EIS addressed a lot of things, how this will, you know, affect trees and animals in the area. One thing it didn't touch on, though, is what happens to what lives in the sand. These are the worms, the crabs, the shrimp that we don't always see as humans, but that are food for fish and birds. I spoke with some researchers at the University of California who studied beach replenishment in San Diego, and they found that these sand replenishment projects can be fatal to the critters that live in the sand, and that can have wider implications for the ecosystem.
So what does, I guess, the state say about that?
Well, the city and the state didn't seem too concerned. They basically said, you know, look, we have to do this project. I guess alternative is the beach erodes and, you know, we lose our beaches. So they said that the risk is kind of worth the reward in this case.
Well, I know Sam Lemo with DLNR, the Department of Land and Natural Resources, he was involved with the replenishing project in Waikiki. What does he say about this? I mean, does he think it's a major impact?
Yeah, there were some mixed results with that Waikiki project. On one hand, researchers who did a survey after that replenishment project found that there was no significant impact to things like sea urchins and sea cucumbers, but they did say there was a significant decrease in diversity. Lemo wasn't really able to give me further information on why that is, but he suggested it wasn't because of the sand replenishment project. But the scientists I spoke with said really more research is needed to see what the long-term environmental impacts of these projects can be.
Is this just a kind of a thing where it's like, you know, we're talking about the life on the lower end of the food chain here?
Exactly, yeah. These are the small things that we probably don't even notice when we go to the beach, the little crabs that kind of burrow in the sand. But it is a big deal if you're a fish and that's what you rely on to eat. So it can have effects going all the way up the food chain.
Now, I know that I often see a lot of turtles in the area, but there aren't a lot of fish. And even on the reef, there's maybe just, you know, limited, like, sponges, but it's not as abundant as, you know, other beaches around the island, around Oahu.
Right, and that was one of the points made by Sam Lemo with the state, that, you know, Ala Moana, like Waikiki Beach, is a man-made beach. It's not, you know, one of the more abundant, like, major coral reefs that we have. So, you know, if we're going to do a project like this, it's sort of more acceptable to do it on an artificial beach versus one of those other places.
Yeah, and so as far as the city then, they're just saying, well, if this really improves the area for recreation, that it kind of outweighs the risk to these crabs and things on the sand?
Yeah, I mean, when you think about the alternative, beach replenishment is seen as a more eco-friendly, you know, alternative to something like seawalls, which puts a barrier on the beach that actually exacerbates erosion. So basically, with sea level rise and erosion challenges, we're forced to make some really tough decisions, and sometimes there's trade-offs, and the exact implications of what that will be at Ala Moana is yet to be seen.
And does the city have, like, a timetable on when they want to begin this replenishment?
Yeah, they said that they want to start next year. They do have a lot of work to do in terms of permitting before then. The final environmental impact statement was just released on Friday, so they have to get a lot of state and federal permissions to start dredging the water, which will be 2,000 feet Makai of the nearest surf break, and putting all that sand on the shoreline. It's a major project. It's 70,000 cubic yards of sand, which is about 21 Olympic swimming pools. So it's one of the larger projects of this kind that we've seen in the state.
Well, I know the city has their Office of Sustainability and Climate Change, so I'm sure they're looking at this project just to see, you know, what can be done to save some of that beach if it's going to go away eventually.
Right, yeah, it's a challenge, and we're going to be seeing probably more of these kinds of projects as we try to save our beaches from sea level rise. So it's just good to think about how our actions are impacting the environment.
Yeah, what are the trade-offs here? All right, well, thanks so much, Christina.
Thanks for having me.
That was reporter Christina Jedra with today's Reality Check, and if you haven't yet read her story on this issue, visit civilbeat.org. Many people may be planning parties as part of the long Labor Day holiday weekend, but state health officials caution that they are seeing a rising trend of foodborne illnesses over the last several years, and they believe that we're making ourselves sick because we aren't taking care to prevent the spread of bacteria and germs. Peter Oshiro is with the sanitation branch and says we all need to pay attention to the basics.
It seems like in the larger community itself, not in the regulated community, in the larger community over the past 3 years, we've seen a rise in the number of foodborne illnesses reported to the Department of Health. So it's gone from about 1,300 maybe in calendar year 16, rose to about 1,800 or so in calendar year 17. Last calendar year 18, I think we had about 2,200. So out of those numbers, these are probable cases that a lot have been reported by physicians through either clinical specimens when people just report themselves to the doctors for general illnesses and they get tested. So they report back to the Department of Health if they have positive lab results for anything. So during that same time period, since we've instituted our placard systems, our new rules, food rules, we've actually seen in fiscal, we use fiscal year for our data, but for in fiscal 17, our disease investigation reported about 175 foodborne illnesses to the program that actually regulates the licensed establishments here. So it went from 174 in fiscal 16 to about 147 in fiscal 17. And in fiscal 18, it's down to 127.
So on the regulated side, you're seeing
a steady drop.
Yes. But just out there in the community, there's a rise.
So what it's telling myself, for someone that's been in the environmental health field for about 30 years now, is that basically people are making themselves sick from eating and preparing their own food. You can imagine how when we go into a restaurant and, sometimes we see some horror stories there, but these are people that get regularly inspected. We never go into people's homes to check them. Most people have no clue how to properly prepare food to prevent foodborne illness. And we feel that that's a big thing coupled with our cultural environment where we all love to eat out. We all love to picnic. Every event we have is centered around people bringing food or us buying food from somebody. And usually it's a combination of both, right? So again, a lot of the illnesses we're seeing is Campylobacter, Salmonella, Shigella. A lot of these are all poultry-based. We eat a lot of poultry in Hawaii. Almost every dish you see at a barbecue is going to have some kind of chicken dish out there. So I think, you know, the way people handle these items may not be doing in the proper manner. So we're looking at ways to maybe do some public health messaging to teach people how to properly handle their own home cooking so they don't make them and friends and relatives ill.
So we're talking like cross-contamination.
Exactly, cross-contamination. Basically not having their food temperatures, refrigerator temperatures proper, not cooking things to the proper temperature is really big, and real simple things like washing your hands before you start eating, making sure that you're not sick yourself if you're the primary cook for the family. So if you do have any kind of, I guess, gastrointestinal maladies, vomiting or diarrhea in the last 72 hours, you really shouldn't be preparing meals for yourself or others. So that's kind of key things that, you know, we don't have any control over in people's homes. But, you know, when we inspect restaurants, we obviously look for things like ill employees. Yeah.
So is the state health department going to try and roll out some campaign around that?
Yeah, so that's what we're working on now and putting together some spots.
I'm thinking at the grocery store with the whole emphasis on the plastic bag ban, right? People are either just trying to carry out all their stuff
in one monster bag, right?
Exactly, yes. Or just in their arms. Yeah. But maybe just something simple as bagging the chicken when you get it from the poultry section.
Well, like even just the fact that you're putting it together in one bag is not a good idea. You have, real simple, just have two bags. One for all your raw, if that's what you're buying, raw meats, poultry, and also bag them separately before you put them into that one bag. But absolutely keep those things separate from any things that you're going to ready to eat, like your produce, your lettuce, anything that you're not going to cook, open cans of beverages that you're going to put up to your mouth or in your mouth. Make sure that they don't get exposed to drippings from things like, you know, your raw chicken or beef that can carry pathogenic organisms.
I know regulators are pushing this whole food safety thing.
Right.
I think the feds are coming out with additional rules, mm-hmm. you know, when it comes to farmers, you know, because maybe they're not handling pesticides properly, or mm-hmm. if it's a situation of a rat lungworm, mm-hmm. you know, just so sanitation's a big deal.
It really is. Yeah. And again, I think people do a lot of things just unconsciously and don't realize what they're doing. And again, it is as basic as washing your hands. It sounds so like common sense, but every study we've seen, if you go into a public restroom, you watch people do their thing, very few people, half, might wash their hands properly. And that's being very optimistic. You know, the number is probably much less than that. So if that's how they do it in public, I'm sure that's how they do it at home. And if people are not conscious of their own personal hygiene, that's where a lot of the foodborne illnesses will start.
Yeah. And I've heard the thing, you wash your hands for 2 minutes, like, you know, sing happy birthday.
Yeah, 20 seconds. Actually, it's, right? it's only 20 seconds.
20
yeah.
seconds, yeah. not 2 minutes.
Exactly. So just under running water, you know, soap your hands up for I guess agitate for about 10, 15 seconds. The other 10 seconds, you just rinse it off and use paper towels to wipe your hands. Yeah.
Something
very simple.
Basic.
Very simple. Yeah.
You said, I think, at one time that you can walk into an establishment and kind of see if people have been trained properly.
Right. And, you know, part of the inspection really is for 5 or 10 minutes, our inspectors will just sit back and watch people handle food, cook food, prepare raw food, and even as they're shift changing coming into work, do they do basic things like actually wash their hands before they start? Before all our inspectors start the inspection, the first thing they do after they introduce themselves is go straight for the hand sink and wash their hands. so before they start any inspection. So that's part of the inspection itself. If that hand wash sink is not available, what I mean is blocked, which you see a lot of times people are starved for space, so they're going to block it with their cutting boards, which means they're not using that hand sink. There's no soap. They might not have paper towels. Real simple things like that. And that's the first thing that we check. So not nationwide, regulated establishments, hand washing violations and temperature violations are the two most violated items. It's universal thing. So these are things that, because we're so focused on it now as the root cause of food illnesses, that's the first thing that inspectors look at is personal hygiene.
Right. And then also, like you mentioned, you know, washing whatever's your produce.
Right. So even, oh, that's key. It's not just the rat lungworm thing. Washing produce, actually your biggest fear should be salmonella, E. coli, things that have gotten on your produce that came from California, the mainland. Those are all our huge outbreaks are coming from. They're not coming from our local farmers. So what that tells you is the way we manage our food supply is changing. So when you have mega farmers that are supplying food to 10, 11, 12 states, you have these huge conglomerates where all these tons and tons of produce are going through the same wash tanks, the same wash cycles. You get one infected employee in that plant, and you infect millions of pounds of product, which is why you see huge multi-state outbreaks now on the same product. Cantaloupes, lettuce, right? All kind of things have come up in just recently, and they're all linked to large-scale farming. So the washing itself, just the physical removal of anything that could have contaminated, is real key to protecting yourself also. So wash all your produce thoroughly, and that will knock off any quote-unquote slugs or things that also cause rat lungworm. So that's real important to do.
I've seen a lot more of the pre-washed produce. So should you just wash it anyway?
Absolutely. Restaurants, we've been putting out the message to them, and they know the rule is very explicit. It does not exempt pre-washed produce from washing. It goes to this. Think about it now. What I just told you about how large-scale manufacturing is done. The same way that they picked that lettuce and bagged it, they're actually handling it more when they quote-unquote triple wash it, which means now people have shredded it. They put it through another wash process and triple wash. If they're using three different tanks, that's really what they're doing. So it's, you can imagine the amount of wasted water if you had to wash these mega corporation, tons and millions of produce in running water that goes down the drain. It's done in tanks. So which means if one tank gets infected, now you just down the line infected every other tank. So we require all restaurants, even though it does say triple wash, they need to wash it again.
Okay, so if you're at home and you buy one of
absolutely
these things,
just do it rinse again. Rinse it off. You don't have to scrub, right, your lid, but make sure you just at least rinse it off and wash it, yes.
And what was the third outbreak that you said you're seeing? So it's salmonella,
Campylobacter and Shigella. Yeah, and they're all either related to raw food items. Yeah, so those are the things that, you know, we got to control from cross-contamination. And, you know, we've never in the past seen things like salmonella on produce, right? Salmonella is a disease that's in poultry. But obviously either birds are in their farm area and they've somehow gotten into the food chain and now they're in the produce, right? People got to remember that farms are not grown indoors, right? 90% of the stuff is grown outdoors and is exposed to environmental as well as other animals, birds that fly over that may be carrying salmonella. So that's how it gets in the chain.
We're seeing a lot more aquaponics.
Right.
Anything you're seeing on that?
Actually, aquaponics have looked very well. We've actually had to repeal one of our rules because it kind of interfered with the theory of how they were growing fish for eating, tilapia typically, and they're growing lettuce and greens on the top. And of course, the nutrients provided by the fish waste feed the produce. Fish waste is safe in the sense that there's no salmonella or E. coli in quote-unquote fish waste, but our rules were very archaic, and it said that you cannot use raw animal waste, and they didn't define what that meant on any produce, period. So that would have just shut down the whole aquaculture industry in the state of Hawaii. So we found a way to just repeal that. We repealed that section of the rule and made sure that the aquaponic farmers could continue to operate. Aquaponics have been a very safe product, and typically, they do take care of a lot of care with their products. So, yeah, we've not seen any problems with local aquaponics produced.
Okay. But yeah, as people are out there barbecuing because they don't want to cook right at home because it's too hot, just
yeah,
be careful
exactly
about the basics when you're out there at a family party.
Right. And especially what we see a lot of, you know, when you marinate, everybody marinates things, beef, chicken, poultry. And what we see a lot is after they finish cooking, people like to sauce the product again with that raw marinade. That's really, really a bad practice. So anything that was used to marinate raw has to be put on the side and never used again. If you go ahead and pour it in a pot and boil it first, then you can go ahead and use it as a remarinade. But what people we see out in the field when we see picnics, I see it all the time. I see them throwing the cooked chicken back into that raw sauce, and that in itself is a big, big problem.
Yeah. Okay, big no-no.
Yeah.
We've been talking to Peter Oshiro from the Department of Health Sanitation Branch. He has a word of warning about how to avoid making yourself and others sick this holiday weekend.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Merriman's Restaurants, with locations on Maui, Kauai, Hawaii Island, and Oahu, supporting Hawaii's farmers, ranchers, and fishermen since 1988.
How do you update a classic centuries-old tradition? Well, an exhibit featuring Chinese landscape artist Li Huayi just opened at the Honolulu Museum of Art this past weekend. We sat down with him and Michael Knight, who is with the Asian Art Museum Foundation and who curated Li's very first U.S. exhibit. They took part in a forum Sunday talking about what makes this art form contemporary.
We did do a major exhibition in 2004 at the Asian Art Museum of San Francisco, and the writing of the catalog was fascinating because what I did was interview him. So I have 19 hours of tape, and if you talk to Hawaii long enough, he'll forget that the tape is on. So I have all this wonderful blackmail material. But a lot of the quotes that show up in the exhibition now, Sean Eichmann has done a marvelous job of drawing those quotes out. There are things that he said at that time, so they're on tape. I've got proof that he actually said them.
He blackmails me.
Oh,
all the time.
He does, huh? Well, now your work—it really is. It's surreal, and it just takes you to another place. And I've been to China, where I've seen some of these incredible landscapes, and you do capture it.
Oh, thank you so much. Basically, I use a Chinese traditional medium, which is ink. It is a pretty much limited medium. But I think, you know, this is exactly why it existing. And I'm so happy you can read out some message inside. I think, you know, mostly we... Do you notice in my painting there is no human being?
Yes.
because what I try to do is like make ourselves as part of the nature more. And then... try to make the stuff timeless, you know, kind of looking.
And do you have a favorite of the many that you've painted? I don't know.
Could be favorite. I think, you know, nowadays at least I'm doing some painting ink with a golden screen, the golden surface. Once I really admiring this expanding power of the golden color. Other things like I because I'm older, so I look at these older trees still have life with them. You know, I really will move. So I mostly do some tree, you know, something like that.
So talk about the scale of your paintings.
Actually, Chinese scale, which is very much difficult for some beginning, because the problem is. Chinese painting, you never can cover it. No power of covering. And the mistake you made will be always there. So what we learn is start from mistake. You know, because like one stroke, you cannot decide it looks beautiful or ugly. But by second one, you can change it. So some mistake will become a remarkable set off by the followers. So in this way, we'll be okay, everything.
And so, Michael, talk about what it is that you were drawn to with his art.
So one, obviously the works are visually beautiful. I mean, they you can get lost in them and lost in them forever. But also, Li Huiyi has gone back to a very ancient tradition, a thousand-year-old tradition in Chinese art, but made it contemporary by dealing with the landscape. But he also deals with the landscape and explores artistic issues through those landscapes. So if you look at some people who deal with abstraction, then they deal with their artistic issues through abstraction. Huiyi does it with the landscape. So he will take a series, like he's doing now, a series on gold, and he will explore what he can do really in a very abstract and a very kind of artistic sense. He will explore issues of what can he do with that material? What can he do with ink on gold? At one point, he did a series on dark paintings. How dark can I go before the painting gets totally illegible? He has these interesting kind of series of, it's not just gorgeous things, but it's also he's thinking, and he's also solving or setting himself up a series of artistic issues, which then he tackles. And he tackles them both from the sense of kind of Western art theory, but also he's read every bit of Chinese art theory that's ever been written and understands it and is articulated and also brings it out in his paintings. So it's fascinating to look at and to deal with.
Well, having traveled to China and been through some of the most amazing places to see the landscapes, and I think I was in like a rock forest, and I was on the river, and we went by these giant caves and saw millions of dragonflies, and I was just so enthralled at the kind of the mystical feeling that you got from nature. But your paintings really show that.
Thank you very much for compliment. But you are perfectly right, because Chinese thinking with the language is Chinese. So it will be so, let's see, if we think about abstraction, actually some people will think it's very concrete thing. Like you mentioned rock formation, like the wrinkles on the surface of this mountain, and like the texture on the trees. This also will be stimulating or the inspiration for the artist, so to follow their using, adopt their technique, expression, something like that.
And so were you inspired by anybody else's art that helped influence you?
Basically, like Michael said, of course, actual artists will understand very few, but we try to understand more. Because we already talk about that, like Chinese ink painting, which is the foundation, it is a choreographic foundation. So it is related to how you, the way and this connection you use the brush touch. But, some very hidden kinds of connection.
Resubtle.
Yeah, resubtle it is.
Of the different types of phases that you've seen him go through, the dark phase, now the gold phase. Do you have a favorite?
He's accomplished in oil painting. He's done collage. He's done pure abstraction. So he's doing what he's doing by choice. So he has a reason for settling where he is. And his paintings are visually. Right now, one of my people that I work with has one of his gold screens up in a room that is mostly dark but gets a little bit of natural light. And it changes through the day, the way the gold and the ink interact with the daylight through the day. I must say that painting pretty much leaves me in a puddle. It's beautiful, gorgeous painting.
Has your exhibit gone to China?
We had, 2 years ago, we had in the Suzhou Museum, we had a show.
And where is that? Is that in
Suzhou,
Beijing, Shanghai? I don't know.
No, Suzhou, another small city in Jiangsu. But the museum is very famous, designed by Arm Bay. So it's very interesting. And Michael was there also.
Suzhou is very close to Shanghai, just outside of Shanghai. It's a famous garden city, and it was a marvelous exhibition. And Sean curated this show, so he just brought me over to be a talking head, I guess. But he's he's done a marvelous job. This is Sean Eichmann, who's the curator there. He's done a marvelous job on this show.
We are so surprisingly see, because we have preview on the, this display already. This installation, this hanging, this everything, lighting is beyond we imagine.
Wow!
It is really good, really good. I really appreciated the team working with the museum.
Well, that's nice. Then when the artist is impressed with
it is from the bottom of my heart. It is true.
And that Chinese landscape exhibit runs through January and features a series of related workshops over the next several months. For links, go to our website at hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Marco Werman. The World's Newsroom brings you the big picture stories and some other stuff.
You are a Muslim, you are American, and you need to be proud of both, and you need to be.
I was the only Muslim kid. It was the first time I ever kissed a girl. My mom found out, and I knew that I had to make up for it with a lot of prayer at home.
Join us and hear the world.
This afternoon at 1.
That is it for today. Tomorrow, Bill Dorman plans to take a closer look at the strained relations between U.S. and China. Tell us what you think. Suggest a story idea. Call our talkback line. Leave your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find us on Facebook at The Conversation HPR or on Twitter at HI Conversation. And this show and all of our past ones are available on the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. We will be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation. Join us, won't you?